Hey everyone, and welcome to The Image Doctors, part of the Nikonians podcast series. This is episode number 59 for February 7th, 2008. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And we're going to try to make it through this episode despite the colds that we seem to be fighting.
Yeah, it is the cold and flu season.
That's
here,
right.
In Colorado.
especially here in Colorado. Yep. So if we start to hack and cough and die in the middle of the episode, you'll know where to send flowers to.
Where the sniffles to.
Well, we got a fun episode today because a couple things have happened. I've spent a little more time myself shooting with the D3 in a couple of different environments, and so I have some more firsthand experience for that.
And that includes some cool locations, too.
Right. And then PMA was this past week, and so there were some new Nikon product announcements, and we thought we'd weigh in and talk about some of the new announcements as they relate to these perspective control PC tilt shift lenses.
Right.
And we'll have our prescription.
I think to start it off, though, you know, we continue to get a lot of questions regarding the D3 and the D300, especially, you know, how does the D300 compare to the D3? And, you know, what I think we've mentioned this before, but to reemphasize it, you know, what I've found, and I did shoot some comparison shots, you know, at lower ISOs, you know, 200, 400, stuff like that, the two cameras produce almost identical results. You know, as close as you're going to get in terms of colors, contrast, detail, all those things. There's really no difference. The only thing you can see if you get really obsessive about it is if you start looking in the deep shadows, or if you did a, you know, kind of like a mid-range boost or something to lighten up those shadows, you'd see a little bit more noise there. But it is just really trivial at the low ISOs. So if that's where you're typically shooting, it's not a big deal. You know, shoot with the D300, you know, with confidence and get one with confidence. It's a very good camera. It's really at the higher ISOs. You have secondary things there, you know, that you need to think about, you know, format size, the lenses you're going to use with it, those kinds of things. And that gets into a personal preference thing.
But well, it's true. And it came up when I was out shooting a couple weekends ago. So it's definitely something to think about with the kinds of lenses that you're going to put in your bag.
Right. By the way, to counterbalance all those expensive new cameras that we've been talking about, one of the things that we'll do here soon, maybe even next episode, we'll see is our cheap show. We did that a couple years ago and talked about inexpensive equipment that works well and, you know, enable you to get very good images. So we'll talk about the gamut of things, cameras, lenses, accessories, all that kind of stuff on a budget.
Right. So, and it can be done. And it's a really good time for budget stuff. There's a lot of used values out there.
Yeah. That's so we don't feel as guilty recommending the expensive stuff.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I guess we'll start with what I did a couple of weekends ago, which was I went to photograph semi-tame captive wolves. Up in about an hour drive from here, up in near a town called Divide, Colorado. And there's a place there called the Colorado Wolf and Wildlife Center. And you can look them up. It's wolfeducation.org is their website. And they have a certain arrangement that they'll make for private photography sessions. And they're really, really picky about it because the animals are easily spooked, and while they are tame, you can't go and have six people in there. But what they do is they'll take you into the enclosure, and you're there with the handler, the owner of the place, and she will throw treats and little meat snacks to the wolves and then bring them in. And then they're a little shy because they don't know you, and you've got this big camera, and they kind of leery of that. But you can get some wonderful, wonderful images. And I went up there, and it was not early morning. I started about 9:45 in the morning, but up in the mountains, that meant the sun was up. And we had a pretty bright, sunny day, but it was typical. You're in forested area, so you've got areas of bright sun, areas of shade. And so I brought the D3, and I didn't know what to expect. So, you know, as you always do, Rick, I packed way too much. I had my airport addicted, and I was using it as a backpack. I had the 200 to 400. I had the 70 to 200. I had the D300 as a backup camera with the I don't think I brought the 18 to 200, but I brought the 70 to 300 VR that I recently purchased. And so I had all this stuff. And I got in there, I got into the enclosure, and what I did was I started with the D3, of course, because that's what I wanted to really try. And I shot in manual exposure mode with auto ISO. Mm-hmm. And I started with the 70 to 200, and I said, well, I'll just hand hold things and see what I can do first. Oh, yeah, I have my Gitso tripod with the sidekick and the whole nine yards.
In other words, you were taking enough equipment to hate life.
Right. But I didn't know what it was going to be like.
Yeah.
Well, the enclosures, as it turns out, are about 3/4 of an acre in size. So you're figuring about, oh, I don't know. The long side of the enclosure was maybe 200 feet. Mm-hmm. So not terribly huge. And the wolves came fairly close. Well, the tripod sat there for the entire time I was there, mm-hmm. shooting wolves and some foxes. The 70 to 200 that I started with went back into the bag, and I started using the 70 to 300. And the reason why I used it was because I wanted just that little bit of extra reach mm-hmm. with the D3. There was a few times where the 200 millimeter focal length wasn't quite long enough.
Yeah.
And rather than try a I brought teleconverters, but rather than put the teleconverter on, I figured, what the heck, I'll try this little 70 to 300. And that's what I shot with for the rest of the morning, mm-hmm. was just the D3. The 70 to 300 VR, and the images were fantastic. And by shooting in manual mode, I stopped down to f7.1 or something, which is on the long end. That's like 2/3 of a stop closed down. Mm-hmm. And the images are wonderful. And I've posted a gallery of these images at my website, luminescentphoto.com, mm-hmm. and people can take a look at this. But I was just blown away by how well the D3 handled every situation. Mm-hmm. It got the white balance correct. There was a few that when I came back and looked, I tried to warm up a little bit where they were in the shade. But for the most part, the auto white balance got it right. Mm-hmm. The other thing was I never had to shoot above 1600 ISO because it was a fairly sunny day. But even those shots at 1400, as we've talked about before, were incredibly clean.
Right.
In full sun, the only time I had to modify any of my settings were when the wolf was in the shade. There was a lot of snow in the background. And so when the snow was the dominant, and snow in full sun was the dominant background element, the matrix metering got fooled. Mm-hmm. And that's, you kind of expect that because it's a fairly large patch of white in your image.
Sure.
So what I did was I switched to center weighted metering. And a couple of times I dialed in a little bit of plus exposure compensation, but not much, like 2/3 of a stop maybe at the most. And I've made 12x18 prints of these and they look fantastic. Mm-hmm. I think I showed you some of them the other day.
Yeah, they looked very cool.
So that was one real neat, accessible, it's a driving distance from where we live.
And by the way, it's not the only place like that. You know, whether or not a place will have wolves is another matter, because that'll depend, you know, very based on geography. But there are a lot of places out there that rescue wild animals, and that's what this is, right?
Yeah, it's a rescue place. In fact, some of these wild animals were rescued as pups from some of the photography farms. Yeah. And because there's a lot of places out there where you pay money to photograph these wildlife models, and of course they want you to be able to photograph pups in the spring.
Right.
And there was a pair of 9-month-old timber wolves that I photographed who were rescued from there. They were brought in as pups 2 or 3 months old once the photography farm didn't want. This place is a wolf rescue place.
Right. And there are other rescue places like that around the world that take in animals of different types. And it's just something to consider because it's a way to support a good cause.
Right.
And get some, you know, very cool shots that you could not get otherwise. I mean, there's no way in the world you would have gotten the shots that you got. I mean, those would have been very difficult.
Oh, I don't think just the chance encounter of A, me running into a wolf, and B, having any kind of camera ready to take a picture of it just wouldn't happen.
Yeah, they're not easy to photograph.
Now, if you live in the United States, the shooting fees were not cheap. I think it was $300 for a morning. And that was a little bit painful. But on the other hand, the two benefits of this shooting experience where one, I was in the enclosures. It's a tax deductible donation. And so you have to think about it as you are making a contribution to this wildlife center. Oh, and the third thing I suppose is that when you do that, your pictures are yours to use for any commercial purpose if you so choose. So you can sell them. You own the right. You're paying kind of for the rights to do that. And the people on the regular tours, you can go there and just take a tour around. You're not allowed to use a long telephoto lens. You're not allowed to bring a tripod. and you sign a waiver that says you won't use the images for commercial purposes. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of picky, but I understand because they're trying to support their cause, mm-hmm. and they don't want the images to be exploited. Mm-hmm. But it was really fun. Again, that website, if you're in the Colorado area, it's www.wolfeducation.org, and you can take a look at it. And it was really fun. And then a couple of days later after that, I went and did some sports photography mm-hmm. in the worst lighting I've ever experienced. And it was for something called inline hockey. Mm-hmm. And it's a high school varsity inline hockey game. It was a friend of mine at work is the coach of the team. Mm-hmm. And so he said, hey, why don't you come on out and take some of the pictures of the players? Who knows, maybe you can sell them to the parents or something afterwards. It's really hard to get good pictures of inline hockey. And I'll tell you, this was an opportunity for me to shoot fast moving action with the D3 under horrible lighting. We're talking dim indoor, not even arena lighting. And it was those mercury vapor halogen
nasty
lights with weird white balance. And I had mixed results. On the positive side, I got to go onto the other side of the hockey ring. And inline hockey is where they use rollerblades skates, so they're on wheels. Mm-hmm. But it's like a regular hockey game. They all have hockey sticks and they slap
this
little,
each other a lot.
Yeah, it's not quite as physical with the checking as ice hockey is, but still pretty fast pace. And what I did for this shoot was, again, I shot in manual exposure mode with auto ISO. And I was able to get at ISO 5000, 500th of a second at about f3.2, mm-hmm. so just a little bit stop down with the 70 to 200 f2.8. Mm-hmm. Now, here's a situation where even though I could have had more reach with a longer lens, you really need a 2.8 lens in this circumstance, mm-hmm. because the lighting is so dim that you really need to be down around f2.8. You can't get away with shooting an f8 in this arena. I put the camera into the 3D tracking autofocus and fired away at 9 frames a second, but mostly I just shot 3-shot bursts. Mm-hmm. And what I found when I got back was that the images were very, very acceptable. Mm-hmm. They will make 8x10 prints with no trouble. The white balance was correct using auto white balance. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get too much better in post-processing. I could tweak it a little bit, but again, I was impressed by what the auto white balance was able to achieve.
Right.
The downside of the whole thing was that even though I was getting the proper, I was getting shutter speeds that were fast enough to stop the action, these mercury vapor lamps or whatever they are,
yeah,
they're on a power cycle and they flicker in synchronous. Yeah, they're synchronized.
I've seen that before.
And it's bizarre.
Right.
And so what happens is,
people have thought their cameras were broken.
Exactly. And what it looks like, it almost looks like you see the shutter plane through the image. And every 2 out of every 3 shots were coming out up to 1.5 stops underexposed with a real orange-looking color cast in them. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what the heck is this? And then I realize these lamps produce light in a phase, a sine wave almost. And so it's only at the peak of their output that you see that white light. Mm-hmm. If you're shooting at a 60th of a second, it looks fine. As soon as your shutter speed gets up there into the 250th, 500th of a second, which is what you need to stop the action, quite frankly, the quality of the images goes straight to hell.
Yeah. Almost like a little strobe going off.
Yeah, it's just
intermittently.
It's terrible. Yeah. So when I got images that were at the top of the light output, the white balance was correct, the exposure was correct, everything looked really good. And when they weren't, it was really ugly.
Yeah.
Now, some of them I could salvage in post-processing using NX. I could just dial up the exposure compensation, which leads to a little bit more noise. Again, I was already at ISO 5000.
Right.
But by and large, I was truly impressed. I can make an 8x10 print for these parents if should they be interested in that sort of mm-hmm. thing. And I think they'll buy them because mm-hmm. it's better than anything you could do with a point-and-shoot camera shooting through the plexiglass boards in the hockey rink.
Sure.
And it's but the moral of the story was autofocus was great. White balance was great. The light sucked, and there's no way you can get around it without strobing it.
Yeah. And the key in that situation, if you're not going to use you know, external strobes, you know, big things like sports photographers use, and we've discussed those in the past, take a bunch of shots.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe do some tests beforehand just to verify that you've got that kind of lighting source, you know what you're dealing with, and just take lots of extra shots.
Right. I ended up taking through two games. There was two varsity games played that night, and I took something on the order of 600 images. Mm-hmm. And it was great. I had 2 8-gig cards, and when one filled up, the next one, I think I got about 400 lossless compressed 14-bit NEFs on the first card, and then went over to the second card. So I was thoroughly impressed with the performance of the camera. The lighting situation was such that it just wasn't really fun. You could get away with using a couple of SB800s on stands if you had some pocket wizards to trigger them. Mm-hmm. That would work. But you really, that's a case where the lighting is really so bad that you almost need to just bring your light to the party, not because your camera is limited by the light, but just because of the quality of the light itself.
By the way, since we've passed on that info to you about the lighting, if you have photographer friends that are going to go shoot in arenas, mention that to them, because otherwise those poor people are likely to think their camera is broken.
Oh, I've seen it.
Definitely seen that a bunch of times.
I've seen people post in our sports photography forum,
right, just
on the site, and they're like, oh my God, is my camera dead?
Yeah.
Because it does look like it. It looks like the shutter blade is going through and stuff.
Right.
It just depends on how you catch
the
nastier light.
Little things that you could
It's truly bizarre, and there's nothing you can do about it. Except shoot really slow shutter speeds, and you're not going to do that.
Yeah, I guess you could do that panning stuff.
But as bottom line, every time I push this D3 to the limit, and this case was a really good opportunity for me to do that, mm-hmm. I come back very happy.
Yeah.
So
cool.
Don't regret that purchase one bit.
Okay.
So that brings us to our next topic, which is a little bit about tilt shift and perspective control lenses. And what got us thinking about this was the recent announcement at the 2008 PMA show of a new Nikon perspective control tilt shift lens, a 24 right. millimeter. And we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
But we'll spend a little bit of time talking about what these perspective correction lenses do and why you might want to use one. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't own any.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any?
You never know. Maybe. Yes.
I'll take that as a yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so let me ask you, why would someone be interested in a perspective control or a tilt shift lens?
Okay. All right. Let's talk about the gamut of lenses that are out there, because they're lenses that Nikon has made for a long time that are just shift lenses. And they've made 28 millimeter shift lenses, and they've made 35 millimeter shift lenses.
Now, shift is when you move the center of the lens off its axis, right?
Yeah, it just slides horizontally. It's not angling or anything like
right,
that.
Right, it's just think of it on a rail shifting left and right.
Right, exactly.
Not pivoting.
Right, and what this does is it you can do several things with it. The classic problem that it's intended to solve are converging lines on buildings. That problem you have if you have a wide-angle lens, you're up fairly close to a building, you tilt the camera up to get the whole building in, and then you look at the picture and it looks like the building is falling over.
Right. I've taken plenty of pictures like that myself.
Right. And it always ends up looking worse in the actual image than it did in your camera. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Somehow
you don't see it when it's in the viewfinder.
No, it looks fine in the viewfinder by comparison. So by shifting the lens, you can correct the lines in the image and not have that building that looks like it's falling backwards, or at least, you know, reduce some of that. You don't have to take it all out necessarily. And so those older 28s and 35s are good for that. And that was something I still have a 35 shift lens. And when I was using slide film a lot and going on trips like to Europe or whatever with cathedrals and stuff, that's something I took along because it worked pretty well for that. I haven't used it as much lately just because of a couple things. One, the lenses are not very quick to use. They have manual diaphragms in them that you have to stop down to the shooting aperture and then open back up again when you want to focus.
So there's metering challenges.
There are metering challenges above and beyond that too. Like you have to meter before you shift the lens, otherwise you get an incorrect reading. And just getting them set correctly takes a little bit of time. So in addition to all the normal stuff that you do, you have that. And really they work best off of tripods, as you would imagine. Mm-hmm. I certainly shot them handheld at times and at work, but you know, they're a little bit of a handful. More importantly, the reason I haven't been using them as much lately is, for one, on the recent digital bodies, you know, up until the time of the D3, those wide-angle lenses weren't quite as wide-angle, mm-hmm. which meant they were a little bit less useful for the application they were intended. And then also, you know, it's not that hard to do some perspective correction in Photoshop or whatever.
Right.
You know, you can fix some of those problems without too much difficulty and without too much of a reduction in quality. With slide film, it's a little bit tougher, obviously, unless you're scanning it. But that was the primary purpose behind the shift lenses, was that perspective correction. There's a secondary thing that you can do with them that's kind of cool. And again, this works best on the tripod. If you shift the lens to the left, take a shot, then shift it to the right, then you'll end up with two images that overlap somewhat, that span a wider angle of view than the lens by itself, and then you can very easily stitch those together, and you get just a almost perfect seam between the two. And
or lack of thereof.
Yeah, it just doesn't show up much at all compared to normal, and it makes for a nice pano shot. So that's the other way that people have used those. Now,
then you come into
a tilt shift.
Tilt shift.
So the shift part of it is the same. It's what we described. Same exact function. The tilt thing, though, is a different feature. And if you've ever seen someone out using a view camera or something like that,
with the big bellows attached
and stuff, if they're trying to get a lot of depth of field in the shot, you know, some of those classic landscape shots where everything is sharp from foreground to background, tilts are something that gets used a lot. And it was really important with view cameras, and still is, because the longer lenses that you use on those things don't give you as much depth of field. But it's a useful thing even with shorter focal length lenses on smaller format cameras, just for the same thing, depth of field. So if you want everything sharp, foreground to background, tilting the camera lens down will enable you to do that.
And there was an 85 millimeter tilt shift lens that Nikon had for a long time,
it's been
right?
Made for a while, and you know, it can be used for landscape stuff. Again, it was a bit long for that on digital cameras. It was probably a little bit better suited to 35 millimeter ones. But where it got used a lot was in macro work. It's the 85 that's been made up until this point, and a little bit beyond this, I guess. Also was a macro lens. It got down to half-life size, if I remember. And if you've taken a lot of macro shots, you know it's very difficult to get everything in focus up close. And maybe you're shooting a leaf or something like that. Even stop down, there's not much depth of field. And by tilting the lens, you can increase sharpness across the plane of the subject. So it can do that for you too. For a long time, people have wanted wider focal lengths. You know, people that use the Nikon system. Canon's had them for quite a few years, and that was always kind of a bone of contention. I have to admit that I was a little bit jealous, too.
Oh, no.
Of the wild white angle.
Say it ain't so.
I'm afraid so. So, at any rate, what did they come out with?
Well, that was the big announcement, the announcement that surprised me, because I don't have my finger on the pulse of the industry. Mm-hmm. That's a new 24 millimeter tilt shift F35E lens with all the new goodies like nano crystal coat and all the stuff. So it's a very wide angle, perspective, control, tilt, shift, the whole nine yards lens. And what's neat about this lens is that it has an electromagnetic diaphragm control, which will work on the newer digital bodies.
So, which will make it more convenient than what I was describing earlier.
So it will stop itself down, it'll meter properly, and it's going to be expensive, almost $2,000 U.S. is the street price that they estimate, $1,929. So this is the first lens that Nikon's come out with to update their perspective control line in a really long time. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that this is an autofocus lens. I still think it's a manual focus lens. You got to do all that because with all the tilt and shift, you can't have any machinery and mechanism to drive the lens.
It'd be very difficult to do that. I'm not even sure you'd want to do it.
But it's got all the latest optics, the nano coating, ED glass, everything you would expect in a professional Nikkor lens is in it. And it says it should be available soon. And then they've announced the production of two new ones, a 45 millimeter and an 85 millimeter micro. So a macro capable lens. So, so they're basically saying, Nikon's going out and saying, okay, we're addressing this hole in our lineup. We're going to have a full line of tilt shift lenses. At least for people using the newer digitals, especially the D3, I think is where you're going to want to use something like the wide ones. But the 24 isn't too bad, even if you use it on a DX body. I wouldn't think that can be useful for a lot of situations. So and other specs, you can get 11.5 millimeters of shift either direction and 8.5 degrees of tilt. So you can do all your perspective control and your depth of field. Improvements and use it with this very expensive niche lens. And that was what kind of got us thinking. This was the first time that we've seen a lens announced at a show where we really didn't expect that one to come out. Did you expect
it? Yeah, I did.
Okay, well, I didn't really expect it, but I haven't really been paying attention.
Yeah.
I mean, let's face it, we knew that they would have to put VR in the 4, 5, and 600s. We have been seeing PMA shows, which are traditionally consumer-oriented with lots of 18 to whatever. And yeah, there's another new 18 to something, 18 to 60-something or 18 to 85. And we're not going to talk about that. I don't know anything about it, but it'll be nice. But here's a perspective control lens, which is clearly, in my opinion, Nikon's way of saying, hey, times are good.
Yeah.
We're going to come out with something that we know we're not going to sell thousands and thousands of copies of.
Yep. Like I said, I did expect this lens or something similar to it to come out soon. What I was happy about and surprised by was the announcement that the other two tilt shift lenses were coming out soon, including the update to the 85.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that is a pretty strong statement. And these will be nice additions. Again, they're not for every photographer. You have to be pretty patient using these. What I didn't mention is I've got a tilt shift lens for my medium format camera, and it's similar and equivalent focal length to the 24 or maybe a 28 right in there. And it's nice. You can do some cool things with it, but it's not quick. I mean, it takes a while to get set up, to get the focus right. It's a little bit iterative to do that. You get the tilt just down. So definitely not a point and shoot kind of thing.
No.
But for people that want one and know how to use them, very cool thing.
And the important thing is now for someone who might be interested in that down the line, they can look to the Nikon lineup and say, yeah, they have that.
Right.
And it's there and it's not going to hold me back from a purchase that I may or may not make, but it's there that I know I can do it.
Yeah. And quite honestly, a lot of times that's what really matters is that psychological comfort that at some point in the future, if you should want something like that or need it, you can have it. Doesn't always matter that a lot are sold. You know how that works.
Exactly. All right. So that will bring us to our prescription for this week. Because we're going to keep this thing short. Otherwise, we'll go completely hoarse trying to control our cold. But
we already had to put off recording this several days so we could even talk. So.
That's right. We thought of this. This is a prescription for our D200 and D300 users, as well as D80 users, I believe, and maybe even D70 users. And that is something we mentioned sort of before, but using off-camera flash handheld for things like people pictures for portraits. And let's say you have an SB600 or an SB800. The nice thing about those flashes is they can be controlled remotely. And if you have a D200 or a D300 or a D80 that has the pop-up flash that can be set to commander mode, that's the trick. I don't believe the D40s or the D50s have that feature. And I'm not sure about the new D60 camera that was announced, but I'm guessing it doesn't either. You can set the pop-up flash to trigger your main flash. And if you do it right, you can actually dial it in so that the pop-up flash does not produce a strong
You can actually turn it off.
You can turn it off, and it just produces the infrared pulse, I believe. And then you can use, so you can hold the camera in your right hand and hold the off-camera flash without any cords in your left hand. And this was something that was in that Joe McNally video, the DVD, the, what was the light?
Speed of light?
Speed of light. That's the one I was thinking of, yeah. And he does that a lot. And it works really nice with the D200 and the D300, the smaller cameras, because you can easily do this. Mm-hmm. And it's great because you don't cast harsh shadows behind your subject as you would if you used either the pop-up flash or putting the larger flash in the shoe. Mm-hmm. And you pretty much eliminate red eye completely.
Right.
Now, it takes a little practice to aim things right. And one little trick is to put your index finger on top of the flash. And hold it, and so you can use that to point the flash, because your brain kind of knows where your index finger is pointing at. Mm-hmm. So if you do that, it'll help you point the flash a little bit. Mm-hmm. But it's a nice little trick, and it's easy to do, and you don't need any cords, and, you know, look, Ma, no wires.
Right, and it definitely is nicer looking lighting.
Yeah, and the next thing you know, you'll take your images to Walmart, and they'll say, well, this was done by a professional photographer. We're not going to process these.
Right. So there.
So there you go, and you can say, no, I didn't. But you can. You don't have to be a professional to have pictures that look like they were taken by one.
Yep.
So that's what we got for this week. Remember, if you have suggestions for a show topic or a photo prescription or anything, or you just like to hear us ramble on and email us, please do so at talkradio@nikonians.org.
And as always, you can find this in our show notes that are in the Nikonians blog page for podcasts. You know, vote for us on Podcast Alley. Again, we show up as Nikonians Talk Radio.
That's right. So that we will sign off for this episode, and we'll see you again in another 2 weeks.
And hopefully we won't have colds at that
point. That's right. I hope not. All right. Bye-bye.